genocide. And people get pissed off when I say that because the United Nations has its criteria that, you know, you have to be completely decimated, completely removed from your territory in order to be genocide. Bullshit. How the hell are we supposed to stop genocide from happening while it's happening? That we can't call it what it is. The genocide right here in the open, we all know, right? That's why I'm here tonight more than anything else. I mean, you will get a whole lot of people talking about that though. Now, when we talk about genocide in universities in this country, that isn't anything new, right? This strategy of overvaluing natural resources over human life. Like South Africa, the natural resources were
diamonds
and gold, right? Like 96% of the world's gold, 98% of the world's diamonds in South Africa. Here's an easy one, and maybe y'all will join me in unison. How about Iraq?
Oil.
Okay, y'all are staying on quiet. Here's a difficult one. How about Vietnam? That's a good one, but not the main one. How about opium? Vietnam was the number one producer of opium in the world at the time. Which brings me to Afghanistan. Right? We're going to see an increase in heroin deaths in our hood as a result of that. Okay? So nothing new. Considering human beings as a disposable variable and an equation for profit as part of this system. That's what the fuck we're dealing with. Right? Now, I've tried to identify some agents that we can specify and be like, okay. Because it's like, when you start talking about a system, it's like, okay, what's out here? Who are we going after? Who specifically is messing with us, right? So I've identified six agents to the imposition of the neoliberal political economy. The first agents are the G8 countries with the World Trade Organization. Pretty basic stuff. You all know that stuff. The World Trade Organization and G8 countries have the purchasing power to decide our Earth's worth, our resources' worth, our labor's worth, and every country's worth in this planet, right? The second agent is international financial institutions. International Monetary Fund, World Bank, Inter-American Development Bank. These are the big banks and investors that are supposedly trying to help poor people out and build their websites. And they say, we're trying to help poor people out. That's giving them big-ass loans with huge interest rates. And we see where that's led this country recently, right? The third agent is very obvious, transnational corporations, Levi's, Nike, Coca-Cola, Burger King. They try to put a fucking Taco Bell in Mexico City. Ridiculous. The fourth and final agent is a business, political, narcotics mafia that exists throughout this world, not just in the global south, throughout this world that is truly benefiting from the imposition of this political economy. I want to be real clear. I'm not saying that every businessman and politician in global south countries is a drug dealer. Don't misquote me. But what I am saying is that the most powerful drug dealers, the real ones, the guys with the boats and the planes, not the kids slinging on the corner, not the farmers having to grow stuff, the guys with the boats and the planes and the connections, these dudes, they send their kids to private schools. They go out and they join a country club. They go out dancing. They go on vacation to Bahia. They hang out with the upper crust. And they do invest in legitimate businesses, right? And try to legitimize themselves. That's what we're really dealing with, right? Now, there are some extreme examples in Mexico. Three presidents ago, Carlos Salinas de Gortari, right? His brother, Raul Salinas, is a convicted drug dealer. It's been proven that Raul Salinas got his startup funds from Carlos Salinas, stealing them from the national treasury. The Swiss bank last year just returned millions of dollars of this stolen money to the Mexican federal government. And that's not so bad. The worst part is that now, well, just up until recently, Carlos Salinas de Gortari sat on the board of directors of Westinghouse Corporation, the largest publisher of books in the world, and at one point, the second largest producer of nuclear weapons in the world. He got a $300,000 check a year to show up to $1 million a year. Pretty atrocious.
I wouldn't let you have that much.
Okay, let's see here. Now, I normally wouldn't quote or agree with anything Felipe Calderon has to say, but I think it's important because Obama's there today and they're making all this hype on the news, whatever, whatever. Felipe Calderon, about a month ago, the president of Mexico, about a month ago, told the U.S. government, he says, look, drug trafficking that is coming to my country, it's happening, and it's happening because there is corruption in the government. I'm willing to admit that. But is the United States willing to admit that the drugs that are coming into its country are largely as a result of corruption in your government? Right? You didn't hear that on CNN, did you? No. It came out, and Lou Dobbs did talk about it, and even Lou Dobbs was like, damn. Right? A couple weeks later, the Mexican Catholic Church echoed Felipe Calderon on the issue. Right? And right now, Obama's down and trying to be like, okay. Right? For me. Okay, let me jump ahead here. Now, I want to talk about how these agents of power try to use a legitimate system, right? The loaning process. I just want to go over that one more time. These international financial institutions that say that they're going to give money to global south countries so they can catch up and play ball with the rest of the world, right? These loans, again, have ridiculous interest rates that are impossible to be paid back. Just like the subprime mortgage crisis in this country, that was basically a case of the same damn chicken hawks coming home to feed on the American people, right? These folks have been doing this in the global south for quite some time. Examples, Argentina, 2001, economic collapse. It closed down every bank. People rioted. You got footage of white women in fur coats fucking bashing out the windows of the bank, you know, on YouTube and on the Fourth World War. Pretty crazy stuff. Another really good example I feel people tend to forget of all too often is in Mexico, because of the North American Free Trade Agreement, the National Autonomous University System in 1999 was asked to privatize and raise tuition 500% from one semester to the next. This is the largest university in the hemisphere, housing educating over 300,000 students. Right? What did students do? They rose up and took the campus and held it down for 11 months. Then received a good beat down, but you still pay 14 cents a semester for education in Mexico. Right? I'm not going to bullshit y'all. There's a lot of testing shit coming up, and education isn't necessarily all that accessible, but it sure as hell isn't as expensive as it is here, or as inaccessible as it is here. Okay. This takes me to the fifth agent. Oh, wait, no, I'm sorry. I skipped ahead there. These loans, the international financial institution loans, they have a specific set of stipulations. Some of them are known as Chapter 11. You all may have heard of Chapter 11. Chapter 11 is a subtext on the loans that says the loans have to be paid back as a national priority above all other priorities, above social services, water, healthcare, education, whatever. And there's even, the World Trade Organization even has a tribunal court, a Chapter 11 tribunal court that will sanction your country if you don't pay back the money, or even engage in military intervention if necessary, right? So there's a serious threat. If you don't pay back, you're gonna get thugged, right? So Argentina closed the banks to pay back the money, right? Which is what's gonna happen in a lot of places coming up, so unfortunately. So that's kind of the little scandal there with these guys. Looks a lot like the subprime mortgage crisis, in my opinion. The fifth agent in the imposition of neoliberalism is militarism. I don't feel like we spend enough time connecting militarism to neoliberalism. Military occupation is the most blatant form of imposing a political economy. Soldiers go in and shoot people up. You see it happen. But that's only the most blatant form. Neoliberalism includes much more than military occupation. It includes political occupation, economic occupation, social and cultural occupation, psychological occupation, in the end, spiritual occupation. It is the imposition of a global consumer monoculture. It's racist and it's violent. If you drive down any highway in Mexico City and tabulate the ethnic and racial makeup of characters on billboards, you'll see that 90% of the characters on billboards in Mexico City are white.
Same in the metro.
You see, you You would look at any magazine advertisement, newspaper article, news broadcast, soap opera. I got an ongoing challenge for all my audiences. If y'all find me a Mexican soap opera that has an indigenous woman as a protagonist without having to marry some white guy, I'll give you $100. Y'all let me know. Right? In the most southern states of Mexico, which are the most indigenous states, every women's clothing shop is filled with white mannequins. The same is true in Southern Cali. Right? In Southern California, like Santa Ana, where all the women around are all mannequins. You know? The most prevalent cosmetic products sold to Native women and women of color all over the world is skin bleach. Because indigenousness and color has been devalued into a deathly silence. This is not by accident. This isn't a coincidence. They are trying to kill us, and this is intentional. Now, when we do talk about the military, I like to talk about genocide. I do a lot of these talks in universities, and it's really sickening how when I ask kids, hey, list a couple of countries that you know that had an instance of genocide, everybody, Rwanda, Darfur, Somalia, Germany. And they almost never, ever, ever, unless they've been to like some presentation before, say United States of America. This country was founded on genocide. But somehow students in this country have this idea that the genocide that was perpetrated on this land was at the hands of some pioneer or some pilgrim or somebody landed on Plymouth Rock that had nothing to do with the U.S. Army. Right? But the U.S. Army has engaged and continues to engage in this genocide. Just over 60 years ago, the U.S. Army was still kidnapping Native children from their homes, from their tribes, loading them up onto boxcars, and taking them off to concentration camps that the War Department named boarding schools. 8 out of 10 of the young women that were in these boarding schools were sexually assaulted. 5 out of 10 of the men were sexually assaulted. Less than 50% of these kids survived. There are survivors alive today. You could talk to about this, right? But somehow in the United States of amnesia, this completely is erased from anything we're taught. Now, the U.S. military has been engaging in genocide in the Global South for quite some time throughout Central America, South America. We don't have to go into any sort of conspiracy theory to look at NSC documents or any sort of CIA declassified documents to talk about Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, Nicaragua, Bolivia, Mexico, right? Recently, the 1968 massacre of Tlatelolco in Mexico City, it was proven that the major officials of this massacre were all CIA operatives. And the major officials that were listed as CIA operatives in the recently declassified information are the president, the secretary of governance, and all the generals responsible for the massacre. Right? Did that make a blur by the news? No, it didn't. The U.S. government has been engaging in military intervention in this hemisphere's global south since 1823 with the signing of the Monroe Doctrine. This is this hemisphere's largest mafia move ever. The United States tells Europe, stay the fuck out, and tells Latin America, we're taking over. We got your back. You have our protection now. Right? There's nothing more soprano than that. Right? Now, let me list off some other stuff. This country, we have a military training school known as the School of the Americas. Recently, they changed their name to the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation. This military training base began in Panama and moved to Columbus, Georgia, to a military base known as Fort Benning. And every year for the last 19 years, people of faith, there's some tears of church too, bro. People of faith have been protesting at the gates of this military base, demanding its closure. The people of faith started protesting at it because they were able to originally uncover some training manuals that talked about talents or agency, yada yada, but specified coercion tactics, torture, kidnapping, rape, the creation of paramilitary groups, political and media manipulation. Right? You can see these training manuals on SOAW.org if you're interested. Some of the characters that have been trained, basically what the School of Americas does is it trains Latin American militaries in what they say counterinsurgency tactics. Recently they changed it to counterterrorism, counter-narcotics, but the original mandate was counterinsurgency. Now, the folks that have been trained at the School of Americas are the most atrocious dictators in this hemisphere's history. General Rios Montt of Guatemala, responsible for the murder of over 300,000 indigenous people, trained at the School of Americas. General Augusto Pinochet of Chile, the most formidable torturer in the history of torturers. I've had the distinct displeasure of interviewing some of his victims, right? And I will not discuss any of that because it's just too out of hand. He was trained at the School of the Americas, right? So I've been organizing with the religious folks at the School of the Americas for the last couple of years. Right now we're doing a big push to it's been a largely white event. We're trying to get a lot more people of color out to that SOA this November. And I mean, not trying to block white people from going, but just, try to fill it up with a little bit more of that. And over the years I've been asking the SOA folks, hey, so what's up with Mexico? Can y'all help? Let's figure it out. We got back to you pretty quickly. There's 18 top Mexican military officials trained at the School of the Americas, including General Jose Rubén Rivas Peña, who is responsible for the creation of paramilitary armies in Chiapas, Oaxaca, and Guerrero. He's also responsible for the massacre of Acteal. There are 1,700 Mexican military personnel on active duty that were trained at the School of the Americas. Let me think of another number there. Recently, the U.S. government finished up a grant to the Mexican military for $1.6 billion. The money initiative was called the Merida Initiative. We're calling it Plan Mexico because it's modeled exactly after the money in the counter-narcotics initiative that went to Colombia 10 years ago, Plan Colombia. And you have to ask yourself, has Plan Colombia stopped cocaine from coming into this country? No. Has Plan Colombia stopped paramilitary violence against the Colombian people? So why the fuck are we doing the same shit in Mexico? Why are we trying to turn Mexico into Colombia? My opinion is that Mexico is being systematically criminalized because it's actually proposing alternatives to this system that are very real. Very real alternatives. There's a couple other forms of militarism other than just soldiers. One of them we're seeing in this country more and more, and we need to be significantly more vigilant about it, is the militarization of our police. This is unconstitutional. Our police are looking and acting a hell of a lot more like soldiers than ever before. You go to a protest march, a rally, whatever, you're seeing combat boots, you're seeing platoons, you're seeing submachine guns, you're seeing military vehicles. This is bullshit. And when it comes to uprisings, forget about it in this country, right? In Mexico, we've been seeing the federal prevention police for quite some time. That's been growing. It's been easily noticed. Now, another more insidious form of militarism is what we call paramilitarism. And there's lots of different ways to define paramilitarism, so I don't want to pretend like the way I'm going to define it here is the only one. Right? You could even call militarized police a form of paramilitarism. But for the purposes of this discussion, I will define paramilitaries as militarized civilians. Civilians that have been trained and armed and financed, equipped to kill other civilians, to have deniable atrocities, but the government say, oh, that wasn't enough. That's tribes killing each other. That's gangs killing each other. Right? In Mexico, paramilitarism has permeated all walks of life. It's not just in rural areas like Chiapas, in the jungles of Chiapas, Oaxaca, and Guerrero. Paramilitaries are in high schools, in colleges, in middle schools. We call them foros. The best translation for foros that we've been able to do in English is urban paramilitaries. People were like, maybe they're not, just so much. But this year, or these last couple years in Oaxaca, they've been busting out Uzis and stuff on campus. So urban paramilitaries is really good.
They've been doing their best though since the 60s,
huh? They were, yeah.
Since the 60s. Let's see here. Okay.
The sixth agent to the imposition of neoliberalism is the American people. And there's a whole lot of reasons. Complicity, arrogance, apathy, you know, all kinds of things. Now I'm not gonna go into all that because we could spend weeks on that. But Americans do consume 50% of the world's resources, produce 40% of the world's garbage. And then my big point, Americans flush their poop with drinking water. 1 billion people in this world don't have access to drinking water. No. No wonder people are bombing us. For real. 1 billion people have zero access to drinking water. Not only do we flush our poop, but we wash our asses with drinking water. Right? That's pretty ridiculous. So I think that that's a real prime example of the level at which we are all complicit and arrogant in this situation. Arundhati Roy says, the American way of life is simply not sustainable because it does not acknowledge that there is a world beyond America. In Oaxaca, I have a tank of water maybe from here to here, about this tall, that a truck has to come and fill up. And we bathe and wash our dishes with that water. Can't drink that water. Our drinking water is in bottles. Right? So real quick solution, put a bucket in the shower. And when you shower, fill up the bucket and flush your toilet with the bucket. For now.
As a couple Mexicans, that goes on a good thing.
But it at least doesn't consume as much. Would you mind not interrupting until the end?
Okay, I'm sorry.
I appreciate it. Thank you. It maybe doesn't help the Mexicans answer your question, but it definitely helps us be less shitty in this world. Okay, now, my next point here has to do with the fact that everything I've just identified for y'all, as maybe I've maybe connected some dots, I know all y'all had probably most of that information, right? There's nothing genius about what I've just presented at all. A 9-year-old child on the blunt end of this situation can break that shit down for you, right? As a matter of fact, most of the people that taught me what I'm sharing with you today are illiterate, are children, are people out in the field, right? This didn't come from no Chomsky like analysis, you know what I'm saying? I like Chomsky, you know, not everything he said, you know. Cool, whatever. What is more difficult is to identify the enemy within. How are we contributing to this? How are we complicit? Right? This next section, and this is for us, I call this section activist imperialism. Right? The idea that more and more in the global north people keep swooping in with these attitudes of solidarity that are every day more paternalistic, creating more codependencies. Right? And so I have a couple key words that I feel like if we start to break down, we can begin to challenge this fake-ass solidarity, right? The first word is empowerment, right? You hear this a lot with nonprofits and NGOs. Our organization empowers youth of color to find themselves, to discover the truth. Our organization empowers women. Our organization is empowering indigenous people, right? That is the most condescending shit you can say to somebody. Because what it does is it places power in the hands of the activists and negates the power of people in and of themselves. And tells the people, you have no power, you're never going to have any power, so I'm going to keep you in the map. Now you got some power. Right? That's some pretty arrogant shit. Now, I don't really have a solution, and for the last couple of years I've been proposing this, like just throwing it out there, like this is my proposal, and we'll have a conversation to figure it out. My proposal is to begin talking about contributing to self-empowerment. How is my solidarity action contributing to the self-empowerment of the people that I'm working with? Am I creating codependency? Or am I actually contributing to their self-determination, their self-subsistence, their self-defense, whatever it is, right? There's a lot of these words, so I'm going to run through them. The next one is sustainability, which I'm sure you guys get a lot around here. Sustainability. The global north, sustainability more and more is being defined as an energy efficient car, a composting bucket, a recycling bin, organic bar of soap, a fair trade mochaccino latte. Products that are manufactured and sold to who? To a bourgeois political class who wishes nothing more than to feel good about themselves for participating in the system. Now look, I'm not saying that those products aren't steps in the right direction, and that sustainable technologies isn't something that we need to be looking into. But to believe that those products are the ends is counter-revolutionary. Because those products do not address what we think sustainability is. In the hood, in our communities in the global south, we define sustainability as one thing: survival. And there are no technologies being developed to contribute to our survival unless we develop them ourselves. And some of the videos will show you some of the stuff we're doing in Mojave. Sustainability is being commodified, is being turned into products. Supposedly corporations are going to save us from all of this by turning sustainability into products, right? In essence, our survival is being commodified. If you can afford to live greenly, well, dope. If you can't afford to live at all, then fuck you. Right? So more and more, maybe we begin to challenge that a little bit. Right? The next one that I have issues with is the NGO, or the nonprofit. Right? NGOs are global nonprofits, whatever. Arundhati Roy does a real good piece on this. She calls it the NGOization of resistance. Right? She says that every day more and more the NGO is doing nothing more than to blunt the edges of resistance. It is becoming the middle person, or the middle thing between revolutionaries and the state. It is turning revolutionaries into 9-to-5 positions with benefits. Right? She cites a couple different things. She says, look, I'm not saying that all NGOs are bad, obviously. You know, most of us are going to end up working in something. But how are we going to challenge this? You have to think about the NGO phenomenon. She says, look, in 2003, as the United States prepared to invade Iraq, they simultaneously prepared the NGOs to go in and fix the shit up. Some arrogant ass shit. A lot of the money for the NGOs that went to fix shit up were from the weapons manufacturers that bombed shit up to begin with. Right? So think about this in political and economic terms throughout the global south. As this country and the G8 countries and the WTO bombard countries politically and economically, somehow NGOs are supposed to go in and patch it up. Now, due to Chapter 11 and all these structural reforms, federal governments are being forced to retreat from their people, retreat basic services, basic rights. And somehow NGOs are supposed to fill in the gap. And we're supposed to be convinced that they can. It's financially impossible for NGOs and nonprofits to fill in the gaps that are being left in our communities. Period. We can do something to challenge this. We can do something to really think about how our NGOs and nonprofits are working. How are they actually contributing to self-empowering our communities? But I think that that's something that needs to start really soon. Let me do one more of these. I got too many of these words that piss me off. Nonviolence. Now, I'm angry as shit. But I'm not a violent person. And I'm not necessarily against nonviolence. Like, that's cool. If that's your strategy, that's where you're at, cool, that's valid. You know? And for certain places, I think that that's a valid strategy. But what I have issues with is when people who say they're nonviolent exclude me and my people from their movements because we're violent, because we engage in self-defense. We already have the media calling us violent, right? And when we pop off and the media calls us violent, it fucking sucks when the left goes out and says, damn, they're violent. Two, the hood is systematically excluded from all sorts of revolutionary movements. Because it's violent, drug addicted, ganged up, whatever. The list goes on and on and on to exclude the hood, right? So I think it's important to start talking about self-defense on all the levels that have entailed. We're not just talking about picking up AK-47s and setting up barricades and doing stupid shit like that. There may be a time when that's necessary, What I'm talking about is self-defense also means educating, building community centers, building self-determination. Self-defense is all those things, right? And it comes to that, well, then we have to weigh that in. And people in this country that are engaging in political activity better get ready to see the hood get a lot more self-defensive. Real soon, right? And how are we going to stand in solidarity with that? It's exactly what the Compas in Oaxaca and Chiapas are doing, is defending themselves. Okay, I'm going to stop. Let's talk about some positive stuff for a second. How am I doing on time? Okay. Anybody on time?
It's 7, it's 8 o'clock.
It's 8 o'clock. Okay, we're good. So I've been thinking about what specifically it is that the Compas are doing in Oaxaca and Chiapas that we could apply here, right? And there's a lot of things. I came up with 3 key ones that are important to me, but I'm sure there's other ones that we can add to this list. But the first one is self-determination, right? Exercising self-determination, exercising our right to take care of ourselves, to love ourselves the way we want to police ourselves, to govern ourselves and to defend ourselves, right? The problem is that as soon as you begin to exercise self-determination, then you become a true enemy of the state. As a matter of fact, every time anybody has ever tried to exercise self-determination in this country, they've been criminalized. Starting with the Native Americans. Went on a couple hundred years later now to the Black Panthers. Right? Latinos, the Nietas. Any gang that tried to get out of the gang and into the class war, now you're a fucking problem. You're not gonna just be sneaking and fucking over your people. Now you gotta die. Now we're gonna infiltrate you. Now we're gonna incarcerate you. Right? So the second point, which follows in suit, if you're gonna exercise self-determination, then you better be ready to exercise self-defense. Point 2. Right? So again, I wanna be clear with that. I do mean the potential of taking it to the fullest of the limit, but I also mean it's really important to build everything else to that, right? Che Guevara once said, a people who cannot read is a people that is easy to trick, right? Un pueblo que no puede leer es un pueblo fácil de engañar, right? That's such true words. Education is a key to self-defense. And how are they fucking educating us in this country? Are they educating us appropriately? Are we taking charge of educating ourselves enough? You know? People learn in different ways. Some kids learn through hearing, some kids learn through seeing, some kids learn through touching. Are the school systems, our public school systems, actually addressing those different forms of learning? Hell no, they're not. Right? The last of the 3 points to hood liberation is expropriation. Taking it back. The Compas in Chiapas expropriated 4 counties with AK-47s. The Compas in Oaxaca expropriated a city of 1 million people for 6 months, and 2 weeks into their uprising, began to expropriate water, food, buses, taxis, police cars, every single government and state office in the building, in the city. Right? Expropriation was a fundamental aspect of the uprising. Americans have kind of lost touch with that. Not all Americans, you know. But we are seeing some cool stuff. I know you all have some spots here in Oakland, right? Yeah? I know there's some reclaimed spaces. That's what I'm talking about. I want to see a lot more of that, you know? Doing it up in New York in the South Bronx, doing it in Philly. Out here in Cali, you have stuff like this, what happened at the South Central Farm. There's other farms popping up. We need to be willing to take the risks necessary to reclaim what's rightfully ours, and to help people and communities to reclaim what's rightfully theirs too. Expropriation is a fundamental aspect. So self-determination, self-defense, and expropriation. I normally talk about Oaxaca and Chiapas at this point, but with this crowd, I feel like I'd just be, you know, preaching to the choir, right? I think the stuff that I already shared with y'all is really what's unique about the presentation. I want to share one more thing with y'all. And I don't normally share this in all spaces, but I'm really glad that you all opened up this space and we have a diverse group here. The Compas in Oaxaca and Chiapas have a series of principles. We've been calling them the principles of unity and resistance. The Zapatistas originally came out with 7 of them, but others have come about in Oaxaca, and there's many more that have been lost. And these principles prove that the methods of self-governance that the compañeros are practicing are functional, and that just because they've been devalued by the system doesn't mean that they're not valued, right? And these principles are really simple, and it's the only thing that's keeping me from robbing banks. So here we go. The first one is walking by asking. The only way to organize with a community is to go door to door in that community. You can't organize a revolution with 5 people in a community. And as soon as you do that, you leave the community. How are you going to move forward without the community? And door to door is not a metaphor. I mean door to door. Door to door. Hey, what do you want to eat? We did this stuff, my boy, you know, Rolando and I in Austin, we did this door to door, walking by asking on the east side. And we were trying to get this garden going and all this stuff. Everybody's, we need community service hours. Damn. So we created a positive community service hour program. You know, like, would have never even thought about that. That's just one example. Walking by asking. The next one is super simple. It says propose, not impose. A lot of the old guard Latin American revolutions, in particular some of the more hardcore communist revolutions, had a bad habit of imposing. And of excluding, right? Excluding homosexuals, excluding people of faith, etc., etc. The Zapatistas have completely challenged that. They've opened up their movement to everybody and have put the idea that we shouldn't be imposing any politics, proposing, not imposing. The next one is super, super easy. Serve, not self-serve. Serve the movement, serve your community, serve your people. Don't serve yourself, off your people. The next one came out in Oaxaca, and it's one of my favorites. It says, teaching by learning. The only way to teach anybody is to learn from them first. First, you have to learn how people learn to teach them anything, right? And 9 times out of 10, whoever you're teaching, you're going to learn a hell of a lot more from them, right? So teaching by learning. If you think you can be coming with this top-down attitude on that teaching shit, people, they're just not going to be receiving that. So teaching by learning. In my personal experience, I went to Oaxaca, I didn't know how to use a video camera, I wasn't into the stuff that I'm doing now. The compas there were like, yo, cool, why don't you go pick up some skills? And I was like, what? And they're like, well, like video, photo, like audio, like whatever. And I came back. And I picked up some skills, and then I went back. And that's what I've been doing now. So that came teaching by the way, right? Next one is one no, many, many, many yeses. Sorry, I'm reading them in Spanish and translating. One no, many yeses. One no to empire, one no to capitalism, one no to imperialism, one no to the powerful. Many yeses to the different ways in which we resist it. From nonviolence to self-defense. Everything in between. One no, many yeses. Right? The next one is one world in which many worlds may fit. That's just talking about diversity, plurality, and inclusion. The next one kind of echoes that. That on the diversity tip says, we are all the same because we are different. The next one, this one the Zapatistas used, when they rose up, the Mexican federal government offered them 40 acres, something like this, 40 hectares of land and a Volkswagen bug to chill out. You just use some land and a bug and you all chill out. Right? The Zapatistas responded with this one. They said, everything for everyone, nothing for us. Right? We ain't going to sell out. This is a revolution for all poor people everywhere. And we take that very seriously. We're going to give ourselves up for a bit of land and Volkswagen bug. Crazy. Everything for everyone, nothing for us. But the next one is, and this one's kind of tough in a lot of anarchist spaces because we have a bad habit of believing that there's no space for leadership, for leaders, right? But there are spaces. You need media folks, you need folks to deal with community, you know, people take on roles. But if you're in that position, the way you keep leadership roles in check is you lead by obeying. By obeying your collective, by obeying your community, by obeying your constituents, whatever it may be. Right? Lead by obey. Pretty simple stuff. The next one I think is the most difficult for people to grasp. It says, exercise power, not take power. It's a simple idea. It says, we're not in this struggle to take the power of the powerful. We don't want to put another damn fool in the White House and have another dominator above us. We want to exercise our own power as people, collectively. Fuck taking their power. You've seen what their power does. We don't need to take their power. Exercise our own power. The last one is the point at which these principles of unity and resistance become principles of resistance. It says, ya basta. Enough is enough. That's it. These principles, which are a worldview, a way of life, a way of living peacefully, horizontally, and together, now will be our method of organizing to resist you and to defend ourselves against you. Right? This is how we will collectively run out into the streets, do whatever it takes to defend ourselves. I have one more thing to say, and then we'll just watch movies. Does that sound good?
Yeah.
Y'all don't look too tired. Okay, one last thing. The peace in which we exist in this country is a virtuality. It's temporary. It's a fucking lie. Simply because there can be no peace without dignity, justice, and liberty for everybody, everywhere, all the time, period. As long as we believe that this peace is real, as long as we perpetuate its lie, we perpetuate its means. And its means is terror. This peace has been attained and is attained through terror. A compa de Oaxaca one told me, Simón, don't your compas in the States realize that their peace has come about through our terror? This country's peace has been built upon the blood, sweat, and backs, and continues to be built upon the blood, sweat, and backs of many people. So what are we going to do? We're the most powerful, most privileged people in the world. How are we going to take responsibility for that? I really think it's very important for us to begin to challenge our notions about peace and to ask ourselves, what are we really willing to sacrifice in order for everybody to have peace everywhere? Because people realize that our peace exists through their terror. And that's real problematic. And I'm pretty embarrassed about that. So, that's what I'm doing, what I'm doing. So, let's watch some movies, yeah? Okay. I'm going to start with this film from Chiapas that we just did. The Zapatistas have been organizing the other campaign and this anti-electoral politics campaign in Mexico that has gone to global levels. And they just organized their first international festival of dignified rage, where they invited people from all over the world to go to Chiapas, I mean to Mexico City, then Chiapas, and hang out with them. So we went with a bunch of Chicanos, most of them from Cali, a bunch of Oaxacanos that I work with in Oaxaca, these guys that make bicycle machines, you'll see some of their stuff, those kids are from Oaxaca, and with people from Radio Plantón, the Oaxacan pirate radio station, including, I don't know if y'all remember who La Doctora Berta was, but she was like she was known as Dr. Shotgun. I also have a video of her, but I think we'll skip that. She came along with us to support the project. So we go to Mexico City, we hang out there, and it was kind of difficult. I wanted to see if I could, first I was like, maybe I can get everybody's voice out there when they're on this video, but it just wasn't going to work. So I started to think about which of the most marginalized voices in the Zapatista Encuentro might be heard. And I think the ones that people would be surprised to hear is, and it's the first voice heard in the video, is of sex workers that have been organizing in Mexico City under the Zapatista banner. And this is super powerful to hear what they have to say. And, well, you see some footage there in Mexico City, and then we move. We all loaded up in this big bus painted like a jaguar, and we drove to Chiapas and spent the new year with the Zapatistas in Ovenquí. And then, I don't know if y'all, I'm sure y'all remember, this was around the same time that Gaza was getting bombarded. It was really starting to piss us off. We had all this international force in San Cristóbal de las Casas, and we're like standing around like, wow, we gotta do something. So this march was organized in solidarity with Gaza. So the last couple scenes are first in Oaxaca, kids marched to the American Council and they got beat up and detained, and we have some cell phone images of that. And the very next scene is us marching from Sidesti and San Cristobal to the center, to the town plaza. And it has Sukuan Antimacos' voice over the scene. So, 20-minute film. I'll play that first, and then we'll see what else we want.